Camera outweighed nearly all three of them together. He sat up very straight, and his ruff opened wide, stretching like a frill around his head, and gave a small growling roar in answer. A warning. The ferals, so isolated from all the world, likely would not know to fear celestials as anything other than large dragons, for their size and strength. But the strange ability of the divine wind was by far their most dangerous weapon, and without visible means could shatter stone and wood and bone. Temere did not now raise the divine wind against them, but there was an edge of it in his roaring, enough to rattle Lawrence's bones. Before it, the ferals quailed, the red-patched leader's horns flattening against his neck, and like a flock of alarmed birds they all flung themselves up and out of the valley. "Oh, but I did not do anything yet," Temere said, puzzled and a little disappointed. Above them the mountains were still grumbling with the echoes of his roar, piling them one on another into a continuous roll of thunder, a sound almost magnified beyond the original. The white face of the peak stirred at the noise, sighed, and let go its hold upon the stone, the entire slab of snow and ice sliding gently free. For a moment yet it kept its shape, moving with slow and stately grace, then cracks like spider-webs spread across its surface, and the whole collapsed into a great billowing cloud and came galloping down the slope towards the camp. Lawrence felt like the captain of a ship on her beam-ends, seeing the way that would make her broach to. In perfect consciousness of disaster and powerless to avert it, there was no time to do anything at all but watch. So quickly did the avalanche come that a couple of the luckless ferals, though they had all tried at once to flee, were swept up in its path. Tharkay was shouting, "Get away! Get away from the cliff!" to the men standing around the tents, pitched directly in the path, but even as he cried out, the vast eruption spilled off the slope, swept over the camp, and then the boiling mass came seething and roaring across the green valley floor. First there came a shock of cold air, almost physical in its force. Lawrence was flung back against Temeraire's great bulk, reaching out to catch Tharkay's arm as the guide stumbled back, and then the cloud itself struck and tore away the world, like being thrust abruptly face forward into deep snow and held down, a cool muffling eerie blue all around him, a hollow rushing sound in his ears. Lawrence opened his mouth for air that was not there, flakes and slivers of ice like knives scraping his face, his lungs heaving against the pressure on his chest, on his limbs, his arms spread-eagled and pressed back so that his shoulders ached. And then, as quickly as it had come, the terrible weight was gone. He was buried standing up in snow, solidly to the knees and thinning to a solid icy crust over his face and shoulders. With a great, desperate heave he broke his arms free and scraped at his mouth and nostrils with clumsy, benumbed hands, lungs burning until he could drag in the first raw, painful breaths. Next to him Temeraire was looking more white than black, like a pane of glass after a frost, and sputtering as he shook himself off. Tharkay, who had managed to turn his back to the cloud, was in a little better case, already dragging his feet out of the snow. "Quickly! Quickly! There's not a moment to lose!" he said hoarsely, and began to flounder across the valley towards the tents, or where the tents had been, now a sloping heap of snow piled 10 feet deep or more. Lawrence dragged himself free and went after him, pausing to pull up Martin when he saw the midshipman's straw-yellow hair breaking the snow. He had been only a short way off, but, having been knocked flat, he was more deeply buried beneath the snow. Together they struggled through the great drifts, thankfully nearly all soft, wet snow, not ice or rock, but dreadfully heavy nonetheless. Temeraire followed anxiously after and heaved great mounds of snow this way and that at their direction, but he was forced to be careful with his talons. They soon uncovered one of the ferals, struggling like mad to get herself free, a little blue-and-white creature not much bigger than a grayling. Temeraire seized her by the scruff of her neck and dragged her loose, shaking her free, and in the pocket underneath her body they found one of the tents half-crushed, a handful of the men gasping and bruised. The feral tried to fly away as soon as Temeraire set her down, but he caught her again and hissed at her, some broken words of the dragon tongue mingling with ordinary anger. She startled and fluted something back, and then, after he hissed again, turned abashed and began to help them dig. Her smaller claws were better for the more delicate work of getting out the men. The other feral, slightly larger, in motley of orange and yellow and pink, they found pinned at the very bottom of the slope in much worse case, one wing hanging torn and wildly askew. He made low, terrible, keening noises and only crouched, shivering and huddled against the ground when they had freed him.
"Well, it took you damned long enough,"
Keynes said, when they had dug him out. He had been sitting placidly in the sick tent, waiting while the terrified Alan hid his face in his cot.
"Come along. You can be of some use for once,"
he said, and at once loaded the boy down with bandages and knives and dragged him over to the poor, injured creature, who warily hissed them away until Temeraire turned his head and snapped at him. Then, cowed, he hunched down and let Keynes do as he liked, only whimpering a little as the surgeon moved the broken spines back into their places. Granby they found unconscious and blue-lipped, buried nearly upside down, and Lawrence and Martin together carried him carefully to cleared ground, covering him with the folds of the one tent they had managed to extract, lying beside the riflemen who had been standing together very near the slope. Dunn, Hackley, and Lieutenant Riggs, all of them pale and still. Emily Rowland managed to dig her own head out, nearly swimming up through the snow after Temeraire had swept away most of the top layers, and called until they came and got her and Dyer free, the two clutching at each other's hands.
"Mr. Ferris, I make all accounted for?"
Lawrence asked, near half an hour later. His hand came away bloody from his eyelids, rubbed raw with snow.
"Yes, sir," Ferris said, low.
Lieutenant Balesworth had just been dug out, dead of a broken neck, the last man missing. Lawrence nodded stiffly.
"We must get the wounded under cover and manage some shelter," he said,
and looked around for Tharkey. The guide was standing a little distance away, head bent, holding the small, still body of the eagle in his hands. Under Temeraire's narrow gaze, the ferals led them to a cold, encrusted cave in the mountain wall. As they went in deeper, the passage grew warmer until it opened up, without warning, into a great hollowed-out cavern with a pool of steaming, sulphurous water in the middle, and a crudely carved channel for fresh snowmelt running into it. Several more ferals were disposed around the cavern, napping. The leader with the red patch was curled up on an elevated perch atop a levelled-off rise, chewing meditatively upon the leg-bone of a sheep. They all startled and made small hissing noises as Temeraire ducked into the chamber, with the injured feral clinging onto his back and the rest of them following behind. But the little blue-and-white dragon sang out some reassurances, and after a moment a few more of the dragons came forward to help the injured one climb down. Tharkey stepped forward and spoke to them in their language, approximating several sounds of it with whistles and cupping his hands around his mouth, gesturing towards the cave passage.
"But those are my pigs," Temeraire said indignantly.
"They are all certainly dead by now from the avalanche, and will only rot," Tharkey said, looking up surprised.
"And there are too many for you to eat alone." "I do not see what that has to do with anything," Temeraire said.
His ruff was still bristling wide, and he looked over the other dragons, particularly the red patch one, with a martial eye. They in turn uneasily shuffled and stirred, wings half rising from their backs and folding in again, and watched Temeraire sidelong.
"My dear,"
Lawrence said quietly, laying a hand on Temeraire's leg.
"Only look at their condition. I dare say they are all very hungry, and would never else have tried to encroach upon you. It would be unkind in the extreme were you to chase them away from their home that we might shelter there, and if we mean to ask their hospitality, it is only right we should share with them."
"Oh," Temeraire said, considering, and the ruff began slightly to curl back down against his neck. The ferals truly did look hungry, all whipcord muscle and taut leathery hide, narrow faces and bright eyes watching, and many of them showed signs of old illness or injury.
"Well, I would not like to be unkind, even if they did try to quarrel first,"
he at last agreed, and addressed them himself. Their first expressions of surprise gave way to a wary, half-suppressed excitement, and then the red patch one gave a quick, short call and led a handful of the others out in a flurry. They came presently back, carrying the bodies of the pigs, and watched with fixed and staring interest as Gongsu began to butcher them. Thake, having managed to convey a request for wood, a couple of the smaller flew out and returned, dragging some small dead pine trees, grey and weathered, which they inquiringly offered. Shortly Gongsu had a crackling fire going, smoke drawing up a crevice into the high recesses of the cave, and the pigs were roasting deliciously. Granby stirred and said vaguely, "Would there be spare ribs?" much to Lawrence's relief. He was soon roused and drinking tea, hands shaking, so he needed help to hold the cup, though they seated him as near the fire as they could. The crew were all of them inclined to cough and sneeze, the boys particularly, and Keynes said, "We ought to put them all in the water. To keep the chest warm must be the foremost concern." Lawrence agreed without thinking, and was shortly appalled by the sight of Emily bathing with the rest of the young officers, innocent of both clothing and modesty.
"You must not bathe with the others," Lawrence said to her urgently, having bundled her out and into a blanket.
"Mustn't I?"
she said, gazing up at him, damp and bewildered.
"Oh, Christ," Lawrence said under his breath. "No," he told her firmly. "It is not suitable. You are beginning to be a young lady."
"Oh," she said dismissively, "Mother has told me all about that, but I've not started bleeding yet, and anyway, I would not like to go to bed with any of them."
And a thoroughly routed Lawrence feebly fell back on giving her some make-work and fled to Temeraire's side. The pigs were coming to a turn, and meanwhile Gongsu had been stewing the intestines and offal and hocks, judiciously adding from the various ingredients which the ferals had begun offering him, the fruit of their own collections, not all entirely legitimate, some greens and native roots, but also a bushel of turnips in a torn sack, and another bag of grain which evidently they had snatched and found inedible. Temeraire was engaged in a conversation of rapidly increasing fluency with the Red Patch leader.
"His name is Arkady," Temeraire said to Lawrence, who bowed to the dragon. "He says he is very sorry they should have troubled us," he added.
Arkady inclined his head graciously and made a pretty speech of welcome, not looking particularly repentant. Lawrence doubted not that they would set on the next travellers with as good a will.
"Temeraire, do express to him the dangers of this sort of behaviour," he said. "They will all end by being shot, likely enough, if they continue to waylay men. The populace will grow exasperated and lay out a bounty on their heads."
"He says it is only a toll,"
Temeraire said doubtfully after some further discussion,
"and that no one minds paying it, though of course they ought to have waived it for me."
Arkady here added something more in a slightly injured tone, which puzzled Temeraire into scratching at his forehead.
"Although the last one like me did not object, and gave them a pair of very nice cows if they should lead her and her servants through the passes."
"Like you?" Lawrence said blankly. "There were only 8 dragons in the world like Temeraire, all of them 5,000 miles away in Peking, and even in so broad a quality as colour he was very nearly unique, being a solid glossy black save for the pearlescent markings at the very edges of his wings, while most dragons were patterned in many colours like the ferals themselves." Temeraire made further inquiry.
"He says she was just like me, except white all over, and her eyes were red," he said, his ruff coming straight back up and his nostrils flaring redly.
Arkady edged away, looking alarmed.
"How many men were with her?"
Lawrence demanded.
"Who were they? Did he see which way she left, after the mountains?"
Questions, anxieties at once came tumbling over one another. The description left no doubt as to the identity of the dragon. It could only be Lien, the celestial whose colour had been leached away by some strange mischance of birth, and surely in her heart their bitter enemy. In her startling choice to leave China he could read nothing but the worst intentions.
"There were some other dragons travelling with them to carry the men," Temeraire said,
and Arkady called over the little blue and white dragon whose name was Gerni. Being in some measure familiar with the Turkish dialect of these parts, as well as the draconic speech, she had served as interpreter with the pack dragons, and could tell them a little more. The news was as bad as could be imagined. Lien was travelling with a Frenchman, by the description surely Ambassador de Guigne, and from what Gerny said she had already mastered the language from her ability to converse with de Guigne. She was certainly on her way to France, and there could be only one motive for her to have made such a journey.
"She won't let them put her to any real use,"
Granby offered as consolation in their hasty discussion.
"They cannot just throw her into the front lines without a crew or captain, and she'll never let them put a harness on her after all the fuss they made about our putting one on Temeraire."
"At the very least, they can breed her," Lawrence said grimly. "But I do not think for a moment that Bonaparte will not find some way to turn her to good account. You saw what Temeraire did on our way to Madeira, a frigate of 48 guns sunk in a single pass, and I do not know the same trick would not do for a first-rate." The navy's wooden walls were yet Britain's surest defence, and the still more vulnerable merchantmen carried the trade which was her life-blood. The threat Lien represented alone might well alter the balance of power across the Channel.
"I am not afraid of Lien," Temeraire said, still in a bristling mood. "And I am not in the least sorry Yong Xing is dead, either. He had no business trying to kill you, and she had none letting him try, if she did not like it served back again."
Lawrence shook his head. Such considerations would surely hold no water with Lien. Her strange, ghostly coloration had rendered her outcast among the Chinese, and all her world had been bound up in Yong Xing, even more than most dragons with their companions. She would certainly not forgive. He had not imagined, proud and disdainful of the West as she was, that she would ever go into such an exile. If revenge and hatred had moved her so far, they would suffice for more.
Chapter 5
"Any delay now is disaster," Lawrence said,
and Thake sketched out the last stretch of their journey upon the smooth floor of the cavern, using pale rocks for chalk. A course which would avoid the great cities, past golden Samarkand and ancient Baghdad, between Isfahan and Tehran, and take them on a meandering road through wilderness and skirting the edges of the great deserts.
"We will have to spend more time hunting," Thake warned.
But that was small cost by comparison. Lawrence wanted to risk neither challenge nor hospitality from the Persian satraps, which would consume far more time in either case. There was something a little unpleasant and skulking about creeping through the countryside of a foreign nation without permission, and it would be at the very least embarrassing if they were caught, but he was willing to trust their caution and Temeraire's speed to guard against the last. Lawrence had meant to stay another day, to let the men worst injured by the avalanche make some recovery on the ground, but there could be no question of that now, with Lien on her way to France, where she might wreak merry havoc at the Channel, or upon the Mediterranean fleet. The navy and the merchant marine would be wholly unsuspecting and vulnerable. Her appearance would not be a warning, for her white coloration would not be found in any of the dragon books which ships carried, to warn their captains of fire-breathers and the like. She was many years older than Temeraire, and though she had never been trained in battle, she lacked nothing in agility and grace, and likely was more practised in the use of the divine wind. It made him shudder to think of so deadly a weapon placed in Bonaparte's hands, and aimed nearly at the heart of Britain.
"We will leave in the morning," he said,
and stood up from the floor to find a disgruntled audience of dragons. The ferals had gathered around in curiosity while Thake made his diagrams, and having demanded some explanation from Temeraire, they were now indignant to find their own mountain range little more than a scattering of hatch marks dividing the vast expanse of China from Persia and the Ottoman Empire.
"I am just telling them that we have been all the way from England to China," Temeraire informed Lawrence smugly, "and round Africa, too. They have none of them ever been very much outside the mountains."
Temeraire made some further remarks to them in a tone of no little condescension. He had indeed some experience to brag of, having been fêted lavishly at the imperial court of China after a journey halfway around the world, not to mention several notable actions to his credit. Besides these adventures, his jewelled breastplate and talon sheaths had already drawn envy from the unadorned ferals, and Lawrence even discovered himself the subject of a gallery of appraising slit-pupilled stares, after Temeraire had finished telling them he knew not what. He was not unhappy for Temeraire to have an example before him of dragons in their natural state, without any influence of men. The feral's existence offered a happy contrast with the elevated circumstances of the Chinese dragons, by which comparison the lot of British dragons need not look so very ill, and he was glad Temeraire so plainly felt his own position superior to theirs. But Lawrence was dubious of the wisdom of thus provoking them into a more active envy, and perhaps to belligerence. The more Temeraire spoke, the more the ferals murmured and looked sideways at their own leader Arcady, with a jaundiced air. Jealously aware that he was losing some of his lustre in their eyes, he was ruffling up the collar of spikes around his neck and bristling.
"Temeraire," Lawrence said, to interrupt, even though he did not know what else to say.
But when Temeraire looked towards him in inquiry, Arcady leapt at once into the breach. Puffing out his chest, he made an announcement in grandiose tones, which sent a quick murmur of excitement around the other ferals.
"Oh,"
Temeraire said, tail twitching doubtfully, and regarding the red patch dragon.
"What is it?"
Lawrence said, alarmed.
"He says he will come with us to Istanbul and meet the Sultan," Temeraire explained.
This amiable project, while less violent than the challenge Lawrence had feared, was nearly as inconvenient, and argument was of no use. Arcady would not be dissuaded, and many of the other dragons now began to insist that they too would come along. Tharkay gave up the effort after a short while and turned away, shrugging.
"We may as well resign ourselves. There is little we can do to prevent their following unless you mean to attack them."
Nearly all the ferals set out with them the next morning, saving a few too indolent or too incurious to be bothered, and the little broken-winged one they had rescued from the avalanche, who stood looking after them at the mouth of the cave and making small unhappy cries as they left. They made difficult company, noisy and excitable, and quick to fall to squabbling in mid-air, two or three of them tumbling head over tail in a wild flurry of hissing and claws, until Arcady or one of his two larger lieutenants dived at them and knocked them apart with loud remonstrances to sulk in private.
"We will never pass through the countryside unnoticed with this circus following behind us,"
Lawrence said in exasperation, after the third such incident, the echoes of the shrieks still ringing off the peaks.
"Likely they will get tired of it in a few days and turn back," Granby said. "I have never heard of ferals wanting to go anywhere near people, except to steal food, and I dare say we'll see them turn shy as soon as we leave their territory."
The ferals indeed grew nervous towards the afternoon, as the mountains began abruptly to diminish into foothills, and the smooth rolling curve of the horizon came clear, green and dusty, and endlessly wide under the great bowl of the sky. A wholly different landscape. They whispered and rustled their wings together uneasily at the edge of the camp, and were very little use at all in hunting. As evening fell, the lights of a nearby village began to gleam faintly orange in the distance, half a dozen farmhouses some miles away. By morning, several of the ferals had agreed amongst themselves that this must be Istanbul. It was not nearly so nice as they had expected, and they were quite ready to go home.
"But that is not Istanbul at all," Temeraire said indignantly,
and subsided only at Lawrence's hurried gesture. They were thus rid of the better part of their company, much to their relief. Only the youngest and most adventurous remained, chief among them little Gerny, who had hatched in the lowlands and thus had a little more experience of this foreign landscape, and was quite pleased with this new-found distinction among her peers. She was loud in professing herself not at all afraid, and making mock of those turning back. In the face of her taunting, a couple of the others determined on continuing also, and sadly, these were the most chest-puffing quarrelsome of the lot. And Arcady was unwilling to turn back while any others of his flock remained. Temeraire had told too many stories, and those too vivid, of treasures and feasts and dramatic battles. Now the feral leader evidently feared one of his erstwhile subjects might return at some future date, covered in glory, real or contrived, and challenge his standing. A standing founded less in raw strength, both his lieutenants outstripping him in this arena, than on a certain alchemy of charisma and quickness of thought, rendering his position the less easily defensible. But he was hardly enthusiastic, for all the strutting bravado with which he concealed his anxiety, and Lawrence hoped that he would shortly have persuaded the others to go. His lieutenants, called Molnar and Ring, as best as Lawrence could make out, would certainly have been happier to stay behind even without him, and Ring,
the dark grey, even ventured to suggest as much to her chief, which only succeeded in making Arcady fly into a passion and beat her vigorously about the head, accompanied by a verbal harangue which required no translation. But that night he huddled close with them for comfort, the mountains having dwindled to distant blue majesty, and the rest of the ferals cuddled about them also, paying only half-hearted attention to Temeraire's attempts at conversation.
"They are not very venturesome," Temeraire said, disappointed,
coming to settle down beside Lawrence.
"They only ask me all the time about food, and how soon they shall be feasted by the Sultan, and what he will give them, and when they can go home, though they have all the liberty in the world and could go anywhere they like at all."
"When you are very hungry, my dear, it is hard for your ambitions to rise above your belly," Lawrence said. "There is not much to be said for the sort of liberty which they enjoy. The freedom to starve or to be slaughtered is hardly one to which most would aspire. And," he added, seizing the moment, "both men and dragons may with good sense choose to sacrifice some personal liberty for the sake of the general good, which shall advance their own condition with those of their fellows."
Temeraire sighed and did not argue, but prodded at his dinner dissatisfied, at least until Molnar noticed and made a cautious gesture at taking a bit of the half-abandoned meat for himself, which made Temeraire growl him away and devour all the rest in three tremendous gulps. They had fine weather the next day, the sky clear and vast, which worked to excellent discouraging effect upon their travelling companions. Lawrence was sure that evening would see the last of them turn tail for home, but they made only a poor show of hunting again, and Lawrence was forced to send Tharkay with some of the men to try and find a farm nearby, and buy some cattle to make up the difference. The ferals grew round-eyed at the great, horned, brown beasts as they were dragged into the camp, lowing in pitiful fear, and even more so when they were given four to divide up amongst themselves, gorging near to ecstasy. The littler ones lay on their backs afterwards, with their wings splayed awkwardly out of the way, and their limbs curled over their distended bellies, beatific expressions on their faces, and even Arcady, who had done his best to eat nearly an entire cow alone, sprawled limp-legged on his side. Lawrence sinkingly gathered they had never tasted beef before, and certainly not like this farm-raised cattle, fat and sweet-flavoured. They would have made very good eating even for the finest table in England, and must have been ambrosial to the ferals, accustomed to subsistence on thin goats and mountain sheep, and the occasional stolen pig. Temeraire put the seal to the matter by saying blithely,
"No, I am sure the Sultan will give us something much nicer."
After which Istanbul took on the roseate glow of paradise. There was no more hope of shaking them.
"Well, we had better go on by night as much as we can," Lawrence said in reluctant surrender. "At least I expect any ordinary peasant who sees us will imagine we are part of their naval aerial corps, as much a cavalcade as we are."
The ferals were at least some use once having gotten over their fright. One of the littler fellows, Hertas, greenish-yellow stripes over dusty brown, proved their best hunter in the summer-yellowed grasslands. He could flatten himself in the tall grass and hide downwind, while the other dragons stampeded animals out of forests and hills with their roaring. The hapless beasts would run very nearly straight into his path, and he often brought down as many as half a dozen in a single lunge. The ferals were wary, too, for the scent of men, as Temeraire was not. It was Arcady's warning that saved them from notice by a Persian cavalry company, all the dragons only barely managing to get behind some hills as the troop came riding over the crest of the road and into sight. Lawrence lay concealed a long time, listening to the banners slapping and bridle bits jingling as the company went gradually by, until the sound had wholly faded into the distance, and twilight advanced far enough they could risk taking to the air once again. The feral leader was smug and prancing afterwards, and while Temeraire was still eating that afternoon, Arcady seized the opportunity to take back pride of place, regaling his troop with a long and involved performance, half storytelling, half dance, which Lawrence at first took to be a recreation of his achievements as a hunter, or some similarly savage activity. The other dragons were all chiming in now and again with their own contributions. But then Temeraire put down his second deer to listen in with great interest, and shortly began to put in his own remarks.
"What is he speaking of?"
Lawrence asked him, puzzled that Temeraire should have anything to add to the narrative.
"It is very exciting," Temeraire said, turning to him eagerly. It is all about a band of dragons, who find a great heap of treasure hidden in a cave that belonged to an old dragon who died, and they are quarrelling over how to divide it, and there are a great many duels between the two strongest dragons, because they are equally strong, and really they want to mate and not fight. But neither of them knows that the other also wants to mate, and so they each think they have to win the treasure, and then they can give it to the other, and then the other one will agree to mate to get the treasure. And one of the other dragons is very small but clever, and he is playing tricks on the others, and getting lots of the treasure away for himself bit by bit. And also there is a mated pair who have argued over their own share, because the female was too busy brooding the egg to help him fight the others and get a bigger share. And then he did not want to share equally with her, and then she got angry and took away the egg and hid with it. And now he is sorry, but he cannot find her. And there is another male who wants to mate with her, and he has found her and is offering her some of his own share of the treasure.
Lawrence was by now lost in the sea of events, even so summarized. He did not understand how Temeraire was following it at all, or what there was to be interested in about it. But certainly Temeraire and the Ferals took passionate enjoyment in the entire tangle. At one stage, Guernier and Herthaz even came to blows, evidently over a disagreement on what ought to happen next, batting at each other's heads until Molnar, annoyed at the interruption of the tale, snapped at them and hissed them into submission. Arcady flung himself down at last, panting and very pleased, and the other dragons all whistled in approval and thumped their tails. Temeraire clicked his talons against a broad rock in the Chinese mode of approval.
"I must remember it so I can write it down when we are at home, and I can have another writing box like the one I had in China,"
Temeraire said, with a deeply satisfied sigh.
"I tried to recite some parts of the Principia Mathematica to Lily and Maximus once, but they did not find it very interesting. I am sure they would like this better. Perhaps we can have it published, Lawrence, do you suppose?"
"You will have to teach more dragons to read first," Lawrence said.
A handful of the crew were making some shifts at picking up the Durzag language. Pantomime ordinarily worked quite well, as the Ferals were quite clever enough to make out the meaning, but they were also quite happy to pretend they did not understand anything they did not like, such as being told to move from a comfortable place so tents might be pitched, or being roused up from naps for an evening stretch of flying. As Temeraire and Tharkay were not always handy to translate, learning to speak to them became rather a form of self-defence for the younger officers responsible for setting up the camp. It was rather comical to see them whistling and humming bits of it at the dragons.
"Digby, that will be enough. Don't let me catch you encouraging them to make up to you,"
Granby said sternly.
"Yes, sir. I mean, no, sir. Yes,"
Digby said, gone crimson and tongue-tied, and scurried away to busy himself with a contrived task on the other side of the camp. Lawrence looked up from his consultation with Tharkay at hearing this, surprised, as the boy was ordinarily the steadiest of the ensigns. For all, he was scarcely turned 13. He had never needed to be taken down before, so far as Lawrence recalled.
"Oh, no real harm. He has only been saving the choice bits aside for that big fellow Molnar, and some of those other boys, too, for their own favourites," Granby said, joining them. "It's only natural they should like to pretend to themselves captains, but it is no good making pets of the creatures. You don't make a feral tame by feeding him.
Although they do seem to be learning some manners. I thought ferals would be wholly uncontrollable," Lawrence said.
"So would they be, if Temeraire weren't at hand," Granby said. "It is only him making them mind."
"I wonder. They seem to govern themselves well enough when given sufficient interest in so doing,"
Tharkay observed, a little dry.
"Which seems an eminently rational philosophy. To me it is rather more remarkable that any dragon should mind under other circumstances."
The golden horn glittered from a long way off, the city sprawling lavishly over its banks, and every hill crowned with the minarets and smooth, shining marble domes of the mosques, blue and grey and pink amidst the terracotta roofs of the houses and the narrow green blades of the cypress trees. The sickle-shaped river emptied itself into the mighty Bosphorus, which in its turn snaked away in either direction, black and dazzled with sunlight in Lawrence's glass. But he had little attention for anything but the farther shore, the first glimpse of Europe. His crew were all of them tired and hungry. As they had drawn closer to the great city, there was a good deal more trouble to avoid settlements, and they had not stopped for more than a cold meal and an uncomfortably broken midday sleep in 10 days, the dragons hunting on the wing and eating what little meat they caught, raw. When they came up over the next rank of hills and saw the great herd of grey cattle grazing upon the wide banks of the Aeacian side of the strait, Arcady gave an eager, bloodthirsty roar and dived at them instantly.
"No, no, you cannot eat those," Temeraire said.
Too late. The other ferals were already plunging with cries of delight after the panicked, bellowing herd, and at the southern end of the plain, from behind the ramparts of a squat stone-and-mortar wall, the heads of several dragons, brightly adorned with the plumes of the Turkish service, hove up into view.
"Oh, for all heaven's sake," Lawrence said.
The Turkish dragons leapt aloft and came on in a furious rush towards the ferals, who were too busy to notice their danger, snatching at first one cow and then another, and comparing them in an ecstasy over their sudden riches, too overwhelmed even to settle down and begin eating. That alone saved them. As the Turkish dragons stooped towards them, the ferals jumped and scattered away, leaving almost a dozen cattle crumpled or dead upon the ground, just in time to avoid the reaching claws and teeth. Arcady and the others at once darted straight back to Temeraire for shelter, flurrying around behind him and making shrill, taunting cries at the Turkish dragons, now sweeping up from their dive and coming on furious and roaring in pursuit.
"Run up the colours and fire off a gun to leeward,"
Lawrence called to his signal ensign Turner, and the British flag, still brightly coloured after their long journey but for the pale creases along the folds, unfurled with a crisp, snapping noise. The Turkish guard dragons slowed as they drew near, baring teeth and talons, belligerent but uncertain. They were none of them more than middling in size, not much bigger than the ferals themselves, and as they drew nearer, Temeraire's great wingspan threw a long shadow across them. They were five in number, plainly unused to any great exertions, with odd, dimpled ridges of fat collected in front of their haunches.
"Gone to seed," Granby said, disapproving.
And indeed they were puffing a little after their first enraged rush, sides heaving visibly. Lawrence supposed that they could have very little work, ordinarily, placed here at the capital and on such trivial duty as guarding cattle.
"Fire!"
Riggs called. The volley was a little ragged, he and the other riflemen not wholly recovered yet from their temporary entombment in the ice, and all inclined to sneeze at inopportune moments. Still, the signal had the salutary effect of slowing the oncoming dragons. And to Lawrence's great relief, the captain in the lead lifted his speaking trumpet to his mouth to bellow at them at some length.
"He says to land," Farke translated,
with improbable brevity. At Lawrence's frowning look, he added,
"And he calls us a great many impolite names. Do you wish them all translated?" "I do not see why I should have to land first and go underneath them," Temeraire said.
And he descended only with an uneasy grumble, cocking his head at an awkward angle to keep an eye always on the dragons above him. Lawrence also disliked the vulnerable position, but the offence had been given on their side. A few of the cows had staggered back up onto their feet and now stood trembling and dazed, but most of them were unmoving and certainly dead. A great waste that Lawrence was not sure he could even make good without application to the British ambassador locally. And he could hardly blame the Turkish captain for insisting they make some show of better faith. Temeraire had to speak sharply to the ferals before they would land beside him, and at last even to give a low, warning roar, enough to frighten all the remaining cattle into running even farther away. Arcady and the others came down with a surly, reluctant air, and they stayed only uneasily on the ground, wings scarce furled and fidgeting.
"I ought never have allowed them to come with us so near, without giving the Turks warning first," Lawrence said grimly, watching them. "They cannot be trusted to behave among men or cattle."
"I do not see it is Arcady's fault at all, or the others," Temeraire said loyally. "If I did not understand about property, I would not have known there was anything wrong in taking those cows either."
He paused and added, more low,
"And in any case those dragons had no business lying out of sight like that,
and leaving the cows for anyone to take, if they did not like it."
Even once the ferals had at last descended, the Turkish dragons did not themselves land, but set to flying in a slow but showy circle pattern overhead, very much to drive home their position of lofty superiority. Watching this display, Temeraire snorted and mantled a little, his ruff beginning to flare wide.
"They are very rude," he said angrily. "I do not like them at all, and I am sure that we could beat them. They look like birds with all that flapping.
There would be another 100 to deal with shortly, once you had run these off, and those like to be a different proposition. The Turkish corps are no joke, even if this handful have fallen out of fighting trim, Lawrence said. Pray be patient, and they will get tired of it presently.
But in truth, his own temper was scarcely less short. Upon the hot, dusty field they were exposed to the full force of the sun, the baked ground unforgiving, and they had not carried much water with them. The ferals were not long abashed, and began shortly to eye the slaughtered cows and to make muttered remarks amongst themselves. Their tone was perfectly comprehensible, even where their words were not, and Temeré himself said discontentedly,
"And those cows will only go bad if they're not eaten soon," much to Lawrence's alarm.
"You might try and make the Turks think it does not bother you," he proposed, a happy inspiration. Temeré brightened and spoke to the ferals in a loud whisper. Shortly they had all sprawled out comfortably upon the grass, yawning elaborately. A couple of the little ones even began to whistle rudely through their nostrils, and the play occupied them all. The Turkish dragons soon tired of exercising to so little point, and at last circled down and landed opposite them, the lead dragon discharging his captain. A fresh occasion for dismay, for Lawrence did not look forward to making either explanation or apology. With reason, as the event proved. The Turkish captain, a gentleman named Ertegun, was hotly suspicious, and his behaviour alone insulting. He returned Lawrence's bow with barely a twitch of his head, left his hand upon the hilt of his sword, and spoke coldly in Turkish. After some brief discussion with Tharke, Ertegun repeated himself in a middling sort of French, heavily accented.
"Well, explain yourself and this vicious assault."
Lawrence's own command of even that language was sadly halting, but at least he could make some pretense of communication. He stumbled over an explanation which had not the least softening effect upon Ertegun's offended mien, nor his suspicions, which found vent in something very much like an interrogation on Lawrence's mission, his rank, the course of his journey, and even his funds, until Lawrence began to grow impatient himself in his turn.
"Enough! Do you imagine that we are 30 dangerous lunatics who have altogether decided to launch an attack against the walls of Istanbul with a company of 7 dragons?" Lawrence said. "Nothing is served by keeping us waiting here in the heat. Have one of your men take word to the British ambassador in residence, and I trust he will be able to satisfy you."
"Not without great difficulty, since he is dead," Ertegun said.
"Dead?"
Lawrence said blankly, and in mounting incredulity heard Ertegun insist that the ambassador, Mr. Arbuthnot, had been killed only the week past in some sort of hunting accident, the details vague, and furthermore that there was no other representative of the Crown in the city at present.
"Then, sir, I suppose I must present my bona fides directly in the absence of such a representative,"
Lawrence said, very much taken aback, and wondering privately what he should do for lodging for Temeré.
"I am here on a mission arranged between our nations, one which can allow of no delay."
"If your mission were of so great importance, your government might have chosen a better messenger,"
Ertegun said, offensively.
"The Sultan has many affairs to occupy him, and is not to be disturbed by every beggar who wishes to come knocking at the gate of felicity. Nor are his viziers to be lightly troubled, and I do not believe that you are from the British at all."
There was a conscious satisfaction visible in Ertegun's face at having produced these objections, a deliberate hostility, and Lawrence said coldly, "These discourtesies, sir, are as dishonourable to your Sultan's government as insulting to myself. You cannot seriously imagine we should invent such a story."
"And yet I must imagine that you and this ragtag of dangerous animals coming out from Persia are British representatives, I see,"
Ertegun said. Lawrence had no opportunity to respond to this incivility as it deserved. Temeré was perfectly fluent in French, having spent several months of his life in the shell aboard a French frigate, and he now intruded his massive head into the conversation.
"We are not animals, and my friends only did not understand that the cows were yours," he said angrily. "They would not hurt anyone, and they have come a long way to see the Sultan, too."
Temeré's ruff had stretched wide and bristling, and his wings half rising from his back threw a long shadow, his shoulders coming forward with the taut cords of his tendons standing out against the flesh as he thrust his head, with its foot-long serrated teeth, towards the Turkish captain. Atagan's dragon gave a small, shrill cry and jerked forward, but the other Turkish dragons all by instinct backed away from the fierce display and gave him no support. And Atagan himself took a step back, involuntary, towards the shelter of his anxious dragon's reaching forelegs.
"Let us have an end to this dispute," Lawrence said,
quick to seize the advantage, with Ertegun thus momentarily silenced.
"Mr. Tharkay and my first lieutenant will go into the city with your man, while the rest of us remain. I am quite confident the ambassador's staff will be able to arrange our visit entirely to the satisfaction of the Sultan and his viziers. Even if you are quite correct, there is no official delegate at present, and I trust will also assist me in making good the losses to the royal herd, which, as Temeraire has said, were the result of accident and not malice."
Plainly, Ertegun was not pleased with this proposal, but he did not know how to refuse with Temeraire still hovering. He opened and closed his mouth a few times, then began weakly,
"It is quite impossible,"
which made Temeraire growl in refreshed temper. The Turkish dragons all edged a little further away yet, and suddenly his ears were full of howling, caterwauling dragon voices. Arkady and the ferals were all leaping into the air, tails lashing, talons clawing the air, wings flapping, all of them yowling as loud as they could go. The Turkish dragons, too, began to bellow, fanning their wings, about to go aloft. The noise was horrific, drowning out any hope of orders. And then, to add to the cacophony, Temeraire sat up and roared out over their heads, a long, threatening roll, like thunder. The Turkish dragons tumbled back upon their haunches with cries and hisses, fouling one another's wings, snapping at the air and each other with instinctive alarm. In the confusion, the ferals seized their moment. They darted at the dead cows, snatched them out from under the noses of the Turks, and turned tail as one to flee. Already mid-air, the others flurrying away ahead of him, Arkady turned back with one cow clutched in each foreleg and bobbed his head in thanks at Temeraire. Then they were gone, flying at a great pace on a line straight back for the safe harbour of the mountains. The shocked silence lasted scarcely half a minute, and then Ertegun, still upon the ground, burst out into an indignant, stammering flood of Turkish, which Lawrence, deeply mortified, thought it was better he did not understand. He could cheerfully have shot the whole lot of bandits himself. They had made him a liar in front of his own men and the Turkish captain, already eager to latch upon any excuse to deny them. Ertegun's earlier obduracy had now been superseded by a more honest indignation, violent and very real. He was grown hot with anger, great fat droplets of sweat beading and rolling in long trails down from his forehead to be lost in his beard, furious threats falling over one another in mingled Turkish and French.
"We will teach you how to deal with invaders here. We will slaughter you as the thieves have slaughtered the Sultan's cattle and leave your bodies to rot," he finished, making wild flourishes to the Turkish dragons.
"I will not let you hurt Lawrence or my crew at all," Temeraire said hotly, and his chest swelled out with gathering breath.
The Turkish dragons all looked deeply anxious. Lawrence had before noted that other dragons seemed to know to fear Temeraire's roar, even if they had not yet felt the true divine wind, some instinct warning them of the danger. But their riders did not share that understanding, and Lawrence did not think the dragons would refuse orders to attack. Even should Temeraire prove able to singly defeat a force of half a dozen dragons, they could win only a Pyrrhic victory thereby.
"Enough, Temeraire, stand down," Lawrence said.
To Ertegun he said stiffly,
"Sir, the wild dragons I have already made plain to you were not under my command, and I have promised to make good your losses. I do not suppose you seriously propose to offer an act of war against Britain without the approval of your government. We will certainly offer no such hostility ourselves."
Tharkay unexpectedly translated this into Turkish, though Lawrence had muddled through it in French, and spoke loudly enough that the other Turkish aviators might overhear. They looked uneasily at one another, and Ertegun threw him an ugly look, full of savage frustration. He spat.
"Remain, and you will learn otherwise to your peril,"
and flung himself back towards his dragon, shouting orders. The whole flight together backed away some little distance and settled themselves in the shade of a small grove of fruit trees bordering upon the road leading to the city, which they disposed themselves across. And the smallest of them leapt aloft and flew away towards the city at an energetic pace. Shortly he grew too small to see and vanished against the haze.
"And carrying no good news of us, to be sure,"
Granby said, watching his progress through Lawrence's glass.
"Not without cause," Lawrence said grimly.
Temeraire scratched at the ground with a guilty air.
"They were not very friendly," he said defensively.
There was very little shelter to be had, without retreating a great distance away out of sight of the guard dragons, which Lawrence did not mean to do. But they found a place between two low hillocks and pitched a little canvas on poles stuck into the dirt to give the sick men a piece of shade.
"It is a pity they took all the cows,"
Temeraire said wistfully, looking after the vanished ferals.
"A little patience would have seen them fed, and you also as guests instead of as thieves,"
Lawrence said, his own sorely tried. Temeraire did not protest the reproof, but only hung his head, and Lawrence stood up and walked some distance away under the excuse of looking again towards the city through his glass. No change, except now some herdsmen were driving cattle towards the encamped Turkish dragons so they might eat, and the men were taking refreshment also. He put down the glass and turned from the scene. His own mouth was dry and crack-lipped. He had given his water ration to Dunn, who could hardly stop coughing. It was already grown too late to forage, but in the morning he would have to send some of the men to hunt and find water, at great risk to themselves in strange country, where they could answer no challenge. And he had no clear idea what they might do next if the Turks remained obdurate.
"Ought we not go round the city and try it again from the European side?"
Granby suggested, as Lawrence came back to their makeshift camp.
"There are lookouts posted upon the hills to the north against invasion from Russia,"
Thake said briefly.
"Unless you mean to travel an hour out of the way, you will rouse all the city."
"Sir, someone is coming,"
Digby said, pointing, and the debate was moot. A courier dragon was coming quickly from the city with an escort of two heavyweight beasts, and though the lowering sun was full on them, blotting out their colours, Lawrence saw clearly silhouetted against the sky the two great horns thrust up from their foreheads, the narrower spikes like thorns bristling along the twisting serpentine lengths of their bodies. He had seen a Kazalik once before thus, framed against the billowing tower of smoke and flame rising from the Orient at the Nile, as the dragon set her magazine alight and burnt the great thousand-man ship to the waterline.
"Get all the sick aboard, and unload all the powder and the bombs," he said grimly. A scorching Temeraire could survive, if he could not evade, but even a small unlucky lick of flame might set off the store of gunpowder and incendiaries packed into his belly rigging, with as deadly result for him as for that ill-fated French flagship.
They worked double-quick, leaving the round bombs heaped in small pyramids upon the ground, while canes strapped the sickest men down to the boards to be secured into the belly rigging. Canvas and cloth were flung down, billowing, and the spare leather also.
"I can make a polite noise, Lawrence. You go aboard until we know what they mean,"
Granby suggested, to Lawrence's impatient refusal. The rest of the men Lawrence sent aboard, however, so that only he and Granby remained on foot, well in reach of Temeraire. The Kazilik pair landed together a short distance away, their scarlet hides vivid with markings of black-edged green like leopard spots, and licking at the air with their long black tongues, so close that Lawrence could hear emanating from their bodies a low, faint rumbling, something like the purr of a cat and the hiss of a kettle combined, and see, even against the still light sky, the thin lines of steam which whisked upwards and away from the narrow spikes along the ridges of their back. Captain Ertegun came towards them again, eyes narrowed and dark with satisfaction. From the courier dismounted two black slaves, who with great care assisted another man to descend smoothly from the dragon's shoulders. Grasping their hands, he stepped down onto a small folding set of steps, which they laid upon the ground. He wore a gorgeously appointed caftan embroidered in silks of many colours, and a white, many-plumed turban concealing his hair. Ertegun bowed low before him, and presented him to Lawrence as Hassan Mustafa Pasha, the last a title rather than surname, Lawrence vaguely recalled, and a senior rank among the viziers. This at least was better than an immediate assault, and when the introductions had been coldly concluded by Ertegun, Lawrence began awkwardly,
"Sir, I hope you will permit me to express my apologies."
No, enough,
"Come, let us hear no more of this,"
Mustafa said, his French a great deal more fluent and voluble than Lawrence's, and easily overrunning his stumbling tongue. And reaching out, the vizier grasped Lawrence's hand in his own with enthusiasm, while Ertegun, outraged, stared and coloured to his cheekbones. Mustafa waved away all further apology and explanation, and said,
"It is only unfortunate that you should have been taken in by those wretched creatures. But then it is as the Imams have said, that the dragon born in the wild does not know the prophet, and is as a servant of the devil."
Temeraire bridled at this, snorting, but Lawrence was in no mood to quarrel, full of relief.
"You are more than generous, sir, and you may well believe me grateful for it," he said. "It is paltry in me to be asking your hospitality, having so abused it already."
"Ah, no,"
Mustafa said, dismissing this as of no moment.
"Of course you are very welcome, Captain. You have come a long way. You will follow us to this city. The Sultan, peace be upon him, has already commanded from his generosity that you shall be housed in the palace. We have made quarters ready for you, and a cool garden for your dragon. You will rest and refresh yourselves after your journey, and we will think no more of this unhappy misunderstanding."
"I confess your suggestion is by far more appealing than the demands of my duty," Lawrence said. "We would indeed be thankful for some little refreshment, whatever you can provide, but we cannot linger in port, as it were, and must soonest be on our way again. We have come to collect the dragon eggs, as has been arranged, and we must straightaway get them to England." Mustafa's smile wavered for a moment, and his hands, still clasping Lawrence's between them, tightened.
"Why, Captain, surely you have not come so far for nothing," he cried. "You must know we cannot give you the eggs."
Part 2, Chapter 6. The small ivory fountain, many-jetted, flung off a fine cooling mist that gathered upon the orange tree leaves and fruit hanging low over the pool, ripe and fragrant and trembling. In the vast palatial gardens below the terrace railing, Temeraire lay sun-dappled and drowsy after his substantial meal, and the little runners, having cleaned him off, were sleeping tucked against his side. The chamber itself was fairy-tale lovely. Tiles of lapis blue and white laid upon the walls from floor to gilt-painted ceiling, shutters inlaid with mother-of-pearl, velvet-cushioned window-seats, thick carpets in a thousand shades of red heaped over the floors, and in the centre of the room a tall painted vase, half the height of a man, stood upon a low table, full of a profusion of flowers and vines. Lawrence could gladly have hurled it across the room.
"It is the outside of enough," Granby said, blazing away as he paced, "fobbing us off with a pack of excuses, and then to heap on such vile insinuations, and as good as call this poor wretch Yarmouth a thief!"
Mustafa had been full of apology, of regret. The agreements had never been signed, he explained, fresh concerns having arisen to delay the matter, and as a consequence the payment had not yet been delivered when the ambassador had met with his accident. When Lawrence had received these excuses, with all the suspicion the circumstances commanded, and demanded at once to be taken to the ambassador's residence, and to speak with his staff, Mustafa had, with an air of faint discomfort, confided that upon the ambassador's death his servants had departed post-haste for Vienna, and one, his secretary, James Yarmouth, had vanished entirely.
"I will not say I know any evil of him, but gold is the great tempter,"
Mustafa had said, spreading his hands wide, his implications plain.
"I am sorry, Captain, but you must understand we cannot bear the responsibility."
"I do not believe a word of it, not a word,"
Granby went on furiously.
"The notion they would send to us in China to come here with an agreement only half-made?"
"No, it is absurd," Lawrence agreed. "Linton would have spoken quite differently in his orders had the arrangement been uncertain in the least. They can only want to renege upon it, with as little embarrassment to themselves as possible." Mustafa had smiled, and smiled relentlessly in the face of all Lawrence's objections, and repeated his apologies, and offered hospitality once again, with all the crewmen weary and thick with dust, and no alternative to hand. Lawrence had accepted, supposing, besides, that they would only find it easier to work out the truth of the affair, and exert some influence to see matters set right, once ensconced in the city. He and his crew had been settled into two elaborate kiosks upon the inner grounds, the buildings nestled amidst rich lawns vast enough for Temeraire to sleep in. The palace crowned the narrow spur of land where the Bosphorus and the Golden Horn together met the sea, and endless prospects showed in every direction during their descent. Horizons full of ocean, and a great crowd of shipping on the water. Lawrence only too late recognized that they had stepped into a gilded cage. The matchless views were so because the palace hill was encircled all around, with high, windowless walls that barred all communication with the outside world, and their quarters looked upon the sea through windows barred with iron. From the air the kiosks had seemed joined with a sprawling palace complex, but the connection proved only a roofed cloister open to the air. All the doors and windows which might have led into the palace proper were locked and forbidding, black and shuttered against even the entry of their gaze. More of the black slaves stood guard at the foot of the terrace stairs, and in the gardens the Kazilik dragons lay in sinuously knotted heaps, their glittering yellow eyes slitted open and resting watchfully on Temeraire. For all his genial welcome, Mustafa had vanished away as soon as he had seen them neatly locked up, with vague promises to return very soon. But the call to prayer had come thrice since then. They had explored the limits of their handsome prison twice over, and still there was no sign of his returning. The guards made no objections if any of them came down to speak with Temeraire, in the gardens just beneath the kiosks, but they shook their heads genially when Lawrence pointed over their shoulders to the paved walkway that led towards the rest of the grounds. Held at this remove, from the terraces and windows they could watch the life of the palace as much as they wished, a curious kind of frustration. Other men walking about the grounds, busy and preoccupied, officials in high turbans, servants carrying trays, young pages darting back and forth with baskets and letters. Once even a gentleman who looked like a medical man, long-bearded and in plain black clothing, who disappeared into a small kiosk of his own some distance away. Many looked over curiously at Lawrence and his crew, the boys slowing in their progress to stare at the dragons sitting in the garden, but they made no answer if called to, only hurrying on prudently.
"Look, do you suppose that is a woman over there?" Dunn and Hackley and Portis were jostling one another for the glass, hanging nearly halfway over the terrace railing with 20 feet down to solid stone pavement, trying recklessly to peer across the garden. An official was speaking with a woman. Or a man. Or an orangutan, so far as could be told from externals. She was wearing a veil not of heavy silk, but dark, which was wrapped around her head and shoulders, and left only her eyes uncovered. And despite the heat of the day, her gown was covered with a long coat, reaching to her jewel-slippered feet, and a deep-slashed pocket in the front concealed even her hands from view.
"Mr. Portis,"
Lawrence said sharply. The older midshipman was actually putting fingers to his lips to whistle.
"As you have nothing better to do, you will go below and see to digging Temeraire a fresh necessary, and when he has done with it, you may fill it in again. At once, if you please."
Dunn and Hackley hastily lowered the glass as Portis slunk off abashed, attempting without much success an air of innocence. Tharkay silently relieved them of it, while Lawrence added,
"And you too, gentlemen."
He paused in mingled outrage and dismay to see Tharkay himself peering through the glass at the veiled woman.
"Sir,"
Lawrence said against his teeth, "I will thank you not to ogle the palace women either."
"She is not a woman of the harem," Tharkay said. "The harem headquarters are to the south, beyond those high walls, and the women are not permitted outside. I assure you, Captain, we would not be seeing nearly so much of her were she an odalisque."
He straightened away from the glass. The woman had turned to look at them. A pale, narrow strip of skin, all that the robes did not cover, only just large enough to leave her dark eyes exposed. Thankfully she made no outcry, and in a moment she and the official had walked out of sight again. Tharkay shut up the glass and gave it to Lawrence and walked away, insouciant. Lawrence closed his fist around the barrel.
"You will go and ask Mr. Bell to find you some way to assist him with the newest leather he has to hand," he said to Dunn and Hackley, restraining himself from giving them a sharper punishment duty. He would not make them scapegoat for Tharkay. They made their grateful escape, and Lawrence paced the terrace length again, stopping at the far end to look out over the city and the Golden Horn.
Dusk was descending. Mustafa would surely not come today.
"And there is the day wasted,"
Granby said, joining him as the last call to prayer came. The raw, straining voices of the muezzin mingled from distant minarets and near. One so close it might have been only on the other side of the high brick wall that divided their courtyard from the harem. The call woke Lawrence again at dawn. He had left the shutters all open for the breeze, and so that he might lift his head during the night and see Temeraire safe and asleep in the faint eldritch glow of the scattered lanterns hung on the palace walls. And once again they heard it five times over, with still no communication, not a visit, nor a word, nor any sign that their existence was even acknowledged, beyond the meals which were brought them by a quick and silent handful of servants, there and gone before any questions could be asked them. At Lawrence's request, Tharkay tried to bespeak the guards in Turkish, but they only shrugged, inarticulate, and opened their mouths to show where their tongues had been cut out, a piece of barbarity. When asked to take a letter, they shook their heads firmly, whether from unwillingness to leave their posts for such a purpose, or perhaps under instructions to keep them incommunicado.
"Do you suppose we could bribe them?"
Granby said, when night began to come on, and still no word had come.
"If only we could get out, a few of us! Someone in this damned city must know what has happened to the ambassador's staff. Not all of them could have gone away."
"We might, if we had anything to bribe them with," Lawrence said. "We are wretchedly short, John. I dare say they would sniff at what I can afford. I doubt it would see us out of the palace, when it would mean their positions, if not their heads."
"Then we might have Temeraire knock down a wall to let us out. At least that might draw some notice,"
Granby said, not entirely joking, and flung himself down onto the nearest couch. "Mr. Tharkay, do you translate for me again?" Lawrence said, and went to address the guards once more. Though at first they had tolerated their guest prisoners with good humour, they were now grown visibly annoyed, this being the sixth time Lawrence had accosted them over the course of the day. "Pray tell them we require some more oil for the lamps and candles," Lawrence said to Tharkay. "Also perhaps some soap and other toilet articles," improvising some small requests. These presently, as he had hoped, brought one of the young pages they had seen from afar to fetch and carry for them. The boy was sufficiently impressed at the offer of a silver coin to agree to convey a message to Mustafa. Having first sent him off to bring the candles and sundry, to forestall any suspicion on the part of the guards, Lawrence sat down with pen and paper to compose as severe a formal letter as he could manage, which he hoped would convey to that smiling gentleman that he did not mean to sit quietly in this bower.
"I am not sure what you mean by the beginning of the third paragraph," Temeraire said doubtfully, when Lawrence read over the letter, written in French, to him.
"Whatever your design may be, in leaving unanswered all the questions which—" Lawrence began.
"Oh," Temeraire said, "I think you want conception instead of dessin. Also, Lawrence, I do not think you want to say you are his obedient domestique."
"Thank you, my dear," Lawrence said, correcting the words and guessing at the spelling of heureux, before he folded up the missive and handed it over to the boy, who had now returned with a basket of candles and of small cakes of soap, heavily perfumed.
"I only hope he will not throw it in the fire,"
Granby said, after the boy had trotted away, coin clutched in one fist, not very discreetly.
"Or I suppose Mustafa might hurl it in himself."
"We will not hear anything tonight, regardless," Lawrence said. "We had better sleep while we can. If we get no answer, we will have to think of making a dash for Malta tomorrow. They do not have much of a shore battery here, and I dare say they will answer us very differently if we come back with a first-rate and a couple of frigates behind us."
"Lawrence,"
Temeraire called from outside, rousing him from a thick, too-real dream of sailing. Lawrence sat up and rubbed his wet face. A change in the wind had carried the fountain spray on to him during the night.
"Yes,"
he answered, and went to wash in the fountain, still half asleep. He went down into the gardens, nodding civilly to the yawning guards, and Temeraire nudged at him with interest.
"That is a nice smell," he said, diverted,
and Lawrence realized he had washed with the perfumed soap.
"I will have to scrub it off later," he said, dismayed.
"Are you hungry?"
"I would not mind something to eat," Temeraire said, "but I must tell you something. I have been talking to Bazaid and Sherazde, and they say their egg will hatch very soon."
"Who?" Lawrence said, puzzled, then stared at the pair of Kazilik dragons, who blinked their glossy eyes at him in return, with mild interest.
"Temeraire," he said slowly.
"Do you mean that we are to have their egg?"
"Yes, and two others, but those have not started to harden," Temeraire said. "I think," he added, "they only know a little French and a little of the dragon language, but they have been telling me words in Turkish."
Lawrence paid this no attention, too staggered by the news.
Very nearly since any organized sort of dragon breeding had begun, Britain had been trying to acquire a line of fire breathers. A few of the Flamme de Gloire had been brought over after Agincourt, but the last had died out scarcely a century later, and since then there had been only failure after failure. France and Spain had naturally denied them, too close neighbours to wish to yield so great an advantage, and for a long while the Turks had been no more eager to deal with infidels than the British with heathen.
"And we were in negotiations with the Inca not 12 years ago," Granby said, his face flushed bright with passionate excitement. "But it all came to nothing in the end. We offered them a kingdom's ransom, and they seemed pleased, and overnight they returned us all the silk and tea and guns we had brought them and ran us out of the place."
"How much did we offer to them, do you recall?" Lawrence asked. And Granby named a sum which made him sit abruptly down. Sherazda, with an air of smugness, informed them in her broken French that her egg had commanded a higher price still, almost impossible to believe.
"Good God! How half such a sum was raised, I am at a loss to imagine," Lawrence said. "They might build half a dozen first rates for the same price, and a pair of dragon transports besides."
Temeraire was sitting up and very still, his tail wound tight around his body and his ruff bristling.
"We are buying the eggs?" he said.
"Why—" Lawrence was surprised. He had not before realized Temeraire did not understand the eggs were to be acquired for money.
"We are, yes. But you see yourself that your acquaintances do not object to giving over their egg," he said,
glancing anxiously at the Kazilik pair, who indeed seemed unconcerned at being parted from their offspring. But Temeraire dismissed this with an impatient flick of his tail.
"Of course they do not mind that. They know we will take care of the egg," he said. "But as you have told me yourself, if you buy a thing, then you own it, and may do as you like with it. If I buy a cow, I may eat it. And if you buy an estate, then we may live upon it. And if you buy me a jewel, I may wear it. If eggs are property, then the dragons that hatch out of them are also. And it is no wonder that people treat us as though we are slaves."
There was very little answer to this. Raised in an abolitionist household, Lawrence understood without question that men ought not be bought and sold, and when put on terms of principle he could hardly disagree. However, there was plainly a vast difference in the condition of dragons and the unfortunate wretches who lived in bondage.
"It's not as though we can make the dragonettes do as we want once they hatch," Granby offered,
a useful inspiration.
"You can say that we're only buying the chance to persuade them to go into harness with us."
But Temeraire said, with a militant gleam,
"And if instead, when hatched, they wished to fly away and come back here?"
"Oh, well," Granby said lamely, and looked awkward.
Naturally, in such a case, the feral dragonette would be taken to the breeding grounds instead.
"At least consider that in this case we are taking them away to England, where you will have the opportunity of improving their condition,"
Lawrence tried as consolation. But Temeraire was not so easily mollified, and curled brooding in the garden to consider the problem.
"Well, he has taken the bit in his teeth, and no mistake," Granby said to Lawrence,
with a worried, querying note in his voice as they went back inside.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said dismally. He did have some expectation of winning real improvement in the comforts of the dragons, once back home. He was sure Admiral Lenton and the other senior admirals of the corps would be quite willing to adopt all such measures which their authority should allow. Lawrence had with him plans for a pavilion in the Chinese style, with the heating stones beneath and the pipe-fed running fountains which had been so much to Temeraire's liking. Gong Su might easily train others in the art of dragon cookery, and the Allegiance was carrying home besides the reading frames and sand writing tables, which surely could be adapted to Western usage. Privately, Lawrence doubted whether most dragons would have any interest. Temeraire was unique not only in his gift for language, but his passion for books. But whatsoever interest there was could be satisfied easily and without great cost, and could hardly provoke any objections. But beyond these measures, which might be undertaken within the discretion and the funds of the corps, government was hardly likely to go with a good will,
and the degree of coercion required to force anything more Lawrence could not bear to endorse. A mutiny of dragons would terrify all the country, and surely injure the cause as much as promote it, and fix the ministry in the prejudice that dragons were not to be depended upon. The effects of such a conflict upon the prosecution of the war were hardly to be overstated, and as distraction alone might prove fatal, there were not enough dragons in England for those available to be worrying more about their pay and their rights in law than about their duty. He could not help but wonder if another captain, a proper aviator and better trained, might have kept Temeraire from growing so preoccupied and discontented, and channeled his energies better. He would have liked to ask Granby if such difficulties were at all common, if there were any advice to be had on the matter, but he could not be asking a subordinate for help in managing Temeraire, and in any case he was not sure advice would be of use any longer. To call it slavery, when a dragon egg was purchased at a cost of £500,000, and the only change, whether it should be hatched in England rather than in the Sublime Port, was unreasonable as a practical matter, and all the philosophy in the world could not change that.
"If the egg has begun to harden, how long do you expect we have?" he asked Granby instead, putting his hand up to the wind that came in at the archway facing the sea, and calculating in his mind how long it should be to bring a ship from Malta. They could reach the island in 3 days' flying, he felt sure, if Temeraire was well rested and well fed beforehand.
"Well, certainly it is down to weeks, but whether it is 3 or 10 I cannot tell you without I see the thing, and even then I could be wrong. You will have to ask Keynes for that," Granby said. "But it is not enough to lay our hands upon the egg at the last moment, you know. This dragonette shan't be like Temeraire and pop out knowing 3 tongues at once. I never heard of anything like. We must get hold of the egg and start it on English straight off."
"Oh, hell," Lawrence said, dismayed, and let fall his hand.
He had not even considered the matter of language. He had captured Temeraire's egg scarcely a week before hatching, and had not known enough to be surprised to find him speaking English, more astonished that a new-hatched creature could speak at all. Yet another gap in his training, and another fresh source of urgency.